In our next conversation, we're going to talk about something. Welcome to Gospel Tangents, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett. Critics of the Book of Mormon say the geography features are so vague it could fit just about anywhere in the world. Jonathan Neville is going to weigh in on this issue. He actually kind of agrees with them a little bit. Check out our conversation.
I remember a minute ago you were asking about the traveling by rivers. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the key principles that I employed, you know, to say, well, you can't just assume a distance had to be hacking your way through a jungle. Ancient people always used rivers. Most of the civilizations were built along rivers. So they would use rivers. And in North America, there's such a plentiful supply of rivers everywhere, they could get all over. The second thing was this idea of the land northward and the land southward. Is it a proper noun or a relative term? And people have just assumed, for no reason, in my opinion, that it was a proper noun. But I look at it as a relative term. Just like right now we're in Salt Lake. So Ogden is the land northward, Provo is the land southward. If we were in Logan, Ogden would be the land southward. So it's a relative term. That's why I didn't have a specific name assigned to it. It was just land to the north, land to the south. So when I read those passages in the Book of Mormon that talk about land northward and land southward, I don't assume they're always referring to the same place. I look at where is the speaker, at what point in time is he? At that point in time, and where his main point of reference is, what's the land northward and what's the land southward? You could have the land northward in one area being a land southward in another time. And once I looked at those two things, I thought, okay, this is starting to make a lot more sense. The third one was the narrow neck of land. Everybody, 99% of the people asked me, well, where's the narrow neck of land?
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing narrow between Florida and New York.
I know. And so I say, well, it's in Ether 10:20. And they say, well, what do you mean? I said, this is the only place in the Book of Mormon talks about a narrow neck of land. And it was the Jaredites talking about how the land divides, or the seas divide the land. And they said, well, it talks about it in other places. And I said, no, it doesn't. It talks about a small neck of land, and it talks about a neck of land, but it doesn't say, it talks about a narrow neck, but not a narrow neck of land. Only the Jaredite reference was a narrow neck of land. And when I looked into the etymology and the usage of this all the time, a narrow neck is often used nautically in shipping, because you go through a narrow neck of, it's not of land. You can have a narrow neck of land that's like an isthmus, or you can have a narrow neck of water that you take a ship through, like Gibraltar's kind of a narrow neck of water. And so I think it's important that they said a narrow neck of land to distinguish it from the narrow neck that was of water. And the small neck could be the same thing, it could be land or water. So once I said, okay, they use different terms. Usually when you do scriptural interpretation, different terms mean different things. Otherwise they would use the same term, right? So I started breaking that out and saying, wait a minute, a small neck, narrow neck, and a narrow neck of land could be three different places. And then it opened up the whole geography. I started finding references, like when George Washington was being attacked along the river in New York there. What's the main river?
Is it the Delaware?
No, up there, the river that goes up to the Adirondacks. I can't remember the name of the river.
Susquehanna, I'm trying to
Anyway, it's Hudson River.
Hudson.
So he was being attacked along the Hudson River. There's an old fort there that you can still visit. I was out there a few months ago. And George Washington talked about this narrow neck of land that his forces were confined to, that he had to find a way to get him out of there. And it was just a narrow neck of land between the two rivers. And it wasn't an isthmus. It was just literally a narrow neck of land. And from there, you could lead to the land northward or to the land southward from this narrow neck of land. But that's how he used the term. And I found other similar references to that use of that term. And so once I realized that, I said, okay, literally, a narrow neck of land could be anywhere.
And so it's not Panama, it's not...
I'm glad you asked that, because I want to emphasize to anybody who watches this that I'm not saying this is the gospel truth. Because I don't know. It could be Panama. It could be Malaysia. I'm not saying it isn't. I'm just saying that what makes sense to me is, A, Comoros in New York, because that's what the prophets have always taught. And B, from there, we don't know for sure, But everything described in the Book of Mormon fits in North America, with Gomorrah being in New York. And it's just a question of not, you have to set aside everybody else's interpretation. For example, I've talked to these M2C guys, and they say, well, where's your, I can't remember the phrase in the Book of Mormon, but it talks about a wilderness. And they said, where's your mountainous wilderness? And I said, well, where's yours? It's not in the Book of Mormon. They actually got their Book of Mormon out to show me, and they couldn't find it. And I said, I told you, it's not in there. That's Sorensen's translation. Sorensen inserted that word mountainous. And they all think there's a mountainous wilderness that it's referring to, but it's not in the text. And I pointed out that the Book of Mormon doesn't talk about any city of Zarahemla until you get into Alma. The whole Book of Mosiah doesn't even have a city of Zarahemla. It's just the land of Zarahemla. Because they're all telling me, well, your Mississippi River doesn't work as a da-da-da-da-da. You know, I went through all that with them. And it's just that the Sorensen translation, which I call the M2C translation, has acquired kind of its own authority. And people think the narrow neck of land and the small neck and the narrow neck have to all be the same thing, because Sorensen said they were the same thing. But the text doesn't say they're the same thing. And so just like this, that's what it was, a narrow strip of wilderness, it says in the Book of Mormon. But Sorensen always says a narrow strip of mountainous wilderness. So everybody assumes it has to be a mountain range. So it's these kind of things. And as I got into it, just again, approaching it as a case, as a lawyer, I'm saying, well, I'm not going to pay attention to other people's interpretation. It's like reading these guys that interpret the Constitution, right? If you go to the actual Constitution, it doesn't say what they say it says, right? And that's what the Book of Mormon's like. If you read Mormon's Codex, it's full of Sorensen's translation. And you read the actual Book of Mormon, and it's not the same.
Because I noticed, Mormon's Codex, so you're talking about the abstract map, kind of hour-shaped design.
Mormon's right? Codex is John Sorensen's big, thick, final book.
Oh, okay. So I'm mixing that up with Mormon's map.
Yeah, Mormon's map.
Okay. Because right. Sorensen wrote a short book called
right.
Mormon's Map,
right.
which is supposedly an hourglass-shaped yep. design,
yeah.
which fits really well with Baha, fits really well with Mele.
Yeah.
I've had some people say, well, why don't we just call Florida? Why can't we just limit it to
too.
Florida?
Yeah,
although, no, I don't
too.
Think anybody's come up with a serious
I could.
Thing.
In 5 minutes, I could. No, I'm serious. I did a blog post once where I said, look, I challenged anybody to show me any part of the world that I can't define as Book of Mormon lands using the text. Because the text is vague. And if you read ancient texts, I had to study Greek, and I had to read Xenophon's Anabasis, which is an account of the Persian army the Greek army going into Persia. And you read their descriptions, and it's just like the Book of Mormon. And these people didn't have maps and satellite photos and stuff. They didn't, you know, even Columbus didn't have a map, right? He was just describing where he was headed. And so the people on the ground would say, land northward, land southward. Because that was the general direction that they knew, but they weren't specific, and that's why this idea that you can do an internal map, you know, that's the Book of Mormon Central's big on, or Tyler, or I shouldn't mention names, the BYU guys who developed this map that they're teaching all the students now, is basically Sorensen's map, the hourglass shape. I've talked to them about that too, and they said, well, narrow neck of land, the small neck, and the narrow neck are the same thing. I said, well. That's your interpretation. That's not what the text says. And you're imposing your interpretation on all these BYU students. And all
so you're throwing out this hourglass shape.
Oh, yeah, totally. I'm not throwing it out as a possibility. I'm throwing it out as dogma.
Okay.
And I'm saying if you think that it has to be an hourglass shape, then you're not reading the text. You're reading someone's interpretation. And so I just say the only thing I'm going to go with is the actual text, which is too vague to come up with anything, really, frankly.
It's funny that you mention that, because yeah. I know there are critics of the Book of Mormon that use that to throw out all of them. There's just, the Book of Mormon is so vague, it could be anywhere,
yeah.
and it's, so therefore it's nowhere.
That's right.
How do you respond to that?
I respond to that if you only take the Book of Mormon, you're right. It could be anywhere. It could even be fictional if you're only looking at the Book of Mormon. That's why it's so critical to know what Joseph and Oliver taught. Because they both said it was in America, let's say the Western Hemisphere, But it was, at least it was in this part of the world. And they said Cumorah's in New York. And they couldn't have made it any clearer by saying it was a fact, right? And so that's why, to me, it's either Cumorah or bust, you know? I mean, if Cumorah's not in New York, then there's no reason to think it happened anywhere, seriously. And I know there's a lot of members of the church, even more and more of them now, who think it's fiction.
See, right? And the thing that comes to my mind is what Sorensen said. I'm trying to remember which book that was, but I remember reading it, where Sorensen basically says, Joseph said, well, yeah, Lehi landed in
Chile
or Peru.
Chile,
and then he embraced the Yucatan stuff, and Sorensen basically says two things. One, Joseph embraced a hemispheric model, which I know you disagree with. But number two, Joseph didn't really know.
Right.
You know, he was only, he was given the gold plates, and God didn't reveal everything to him. And so Joseph embraced things like Yucatan and things, but he really didn't know. And so, according to Sorensen, he's reading the text as carefully as he can read it.
Right.
It's an hourglass shape and all that. So
I know. Well, it's not just Sorensen. It's John Clark did a presentation. They had a Joseph Smith bicentennial thing at the Library of Congress, and I think it was 2005. And they had a whole presentation on it. John Clark did a paper where he said that Joseph Smith not knowing anything about the geography is actually evidence that it was divine that he didn't compose it. Because all he did was relate what he read off the stone. That's a whole other topic, but you know, that he didn't know anything about the Book of Mormon, so that proves he didn't write it. That's his argument. And I thought to myself, okay, if you want to go that way, that's an argument. You know, people make arguments. but it's laughable to me, because how could he have been any more explicit? I mean, his mother told us, and she said it, she quoted him even in one case, but his mother said that the very first night Moroni showed up, he told Joseph Smith, this record was in the hill of Cumorah, 3 miles from your house. It's the first time Joseph ever heard the word. It was the first Nephite word he ever heard, other than Moroni, I guess.
See, I know Sorensen says Joseph never called it Cumorah.
I know. I know they say that. But
he just said it was a hill.
I know. And that's what the historians down here at the Church History Department are saying, too. And so I'm saying, well, if you look in the Saints book, they totally decorrelated Cumorah, right?
Okay.
I don't know if you've seen my thing.
I've read that in here, yes.
Yeah. And it's appalling to me, because right in that same Saints book, they quote Lucy Mack Smith's account with authority for most of the account, right, of Joseph's early life. But they deliberately omit what she said about Cumorah. So she said, Moroni told him it was in the hill of Cumorah, 3 miles from his house. And he had to go there and remove the stone was flat, so he had to remove the grass and dirt from the top in order to uncover it. Which was awesome. That's some detail to remember, right? And then later she said, this was in 1827, after he and Emma had been married, they moved to Palmyra to live with the Smith family. And his dad sent him on an errand of some sort down to Manchester. And he came home, and they expected it home. He wasn't home. He came home really late. And they said, what happened? And he says, I've received the severest chastisement in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, his dad wanted to find out which of the neighbors did it. He was, nobody should do that to you. And he goes, chill, Dad, it was the angel Moroni. When I was walking by the hill of Cumorah where the plates are, he stopped me and said, I hadn't been diligent enough, and so on. So, and that was, she put that in direct quotes, that he referred to the hill of Cumorah. This was in 1827, before he ever got the plates. So those two incidents alone, pre-Book of Mormon days, Joseph was referring to it as Cumorah. And the whole family knew it as Cumorah. He didn't have to say.
Now, I want to make sure I understand what your point is there. You're saying in 1827 she wrote this down?
No, I'm saying in her memory, we don't know how.
Because I think the argument is she conflated a lot of stuff. And
that's
so
right.
She may have said Cumorah in 1827, but that didn't come up till later.
Yeah, that's right. You're right. The argument is she dictated her history in 1844 and 1845. So by then, everybody knew it was Cumorah, it was this false tradition that Joseph adopted. Everybody.
Right.
Okay. There's a couple of problems with that. One is that was only when she dictated it. But she told her son William that she had been relating this story so many times she couldn't keep doing it, so she finally wanted someone to write it down. So we don't know if she started relating that in 1830 or when. We know that by 1844 and 1845 she had been relating it for a long time. So for them to say, well, it's late because it's 1844 is kind of disingenuous, because they all know that she had been relating these accounts for a long time. The second point is that she knew about letter 7 because it had been published in the newspapers, right? So even if she was, her memory was, let's say, tainted or augmented by later developments, she was still relying on what Oliver Cowdery wrote in letter 7, which had been widely published and Joseph endorsed it widely. So either of those is an explanation. But I think the most important is that when you read her histories, there are certain things that she actually put in quotes and other things that she just remembered generally. And then someone, we don't know how much she revised it for the 1845 version and how much the other people revised it, because it's not clear. You know, she dictated it, the Coreys wrote it down, and then there were some corrections made to it for an 1845 edition. And it's hard to tell how much of the corrections were Lucy's and how much were the Coreys that made the correction. But the point is, her history is considered reliable. And you can read the Saint's book relies, not exclusively, but largely on Lucy's account, because it's the only account from the early days. And so for them to say, it's like I did with my list of Oliver Cowdery, we believe everything Oliver Cowdery said, and I put them all in green, and then there's just this one little red dot, because what he said about the Hill Cumorah, we don't believe that. But we believe everything else he said, right? It's the same with Lucy Mack Smith. We believe everything she said about all these things. When they always quote, this, I have to tell you, this is funny, because Brian Hales, in your interview with him, brought this up. He said, well, nobody ever said anything about Joseph studying the Bible. It was Lucy said he only perused the scriptures or whatever, you know. And I'm thinking, what the heck? She's the one who said, this is again before he got the plates, that she invited him to go to church, and he said, Mom, I can learn more with the Bible in 2 hours out in the forest or in the woods than I can attending all your church. So he was studying the Bible extensively. He knew it well. And yet Hale said nobody ever said he studied the Bible, you know. So there's these little gaps in history that even historians like Brian Hales are oblivious to or don't know about. But it's in her history right there. If you go through the Saints book, and I've done this, those early few chapters, the primary reference is all Lucy Mack Smith. So they obviously give her enough credence to be reliable regarding all these other events. But when it comes to Cumorah, they just omit that, because that contradicts their whole Mesoamerican thing. And so I'm fine with historians having an interpretation of the facts, but they should lay out all the facts. This gets into my multiple working hypotheses idea, you know?
Right.
I love having all the facts. And I envision
well,
it
I'm
as...
Well, I'm happy that you're willing to engage melee, because most people aren't.
I love melee. To me, melee is just as legitimate as Mesoamerica, because they both say Joseph and Oliver didn't know what they were talking about. And even the African thing, you know? I mean, people say, well, how would the plates get to New York? Well, how would they get to the place from Mesoamerica?
How do they get to Brazil?
Or Brazil, anywhere. But you know, the idea of Moroni going 3,000 miles from their Hill Cumorah down in southern Mexico to New York, when in 1,000 years nobody went that far. Come on, you know, that doesn't make any sense. And there's other practical problems there.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Jonathan Neville, a Heartland expert. In our next conversation, we're going to talk about the final battle in which many people were killed. But is it far less than we traditionally believe?
But there, if you look at what Ether wrote about the Jaredite battle, he tells us how many people died on the last 3 days of that week. It was 1 week of battle, and it was like half, half, half. So I extrapolated it backwards, and it was less than 10,000 people.
If you'd like to hear the entire interview uncut, please subscribe to patreon.com/gospeltangents for just $5 a month. Patreon is spelled patreon.com/gospeltangents. If you'd like to watch the entire video, you can subscribe at YouTube, Patreon, or on my website at gospeltangents.com and click the yellow subscribe button for just $8 a month. PDF transcripts are just $10 a month, and you can get those on patreon.com/gospeltangents or on my website. I'll send those to you as soon as I've finished completing it. If you'd like to get a paperback and PDF, just subscribe for $20 a month at either Patreon or on my website. Individual paperbacks are available at amazon.com. Just do a search for Gospel Tangents interview, and you can find all of our past interviews there. Show your Gospel Tangents pride by purchasing a t-shirt on our website at gospeltangents.com/shop. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts at tinyurl.com/gospeltangents. You can get our latest updates by friending me at Facebook, or you can also follow our page at facebook.com/gospeltangents. Become an insider and you can see the newest videos. Follow us on Twitter at gospeltangents. Click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here we've got some of our great videos. Thanks again.